this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 96 of Art for Your Ear. This episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. You can visit their online gallery at saatchiart.com. Okay, today's episode involves hand sanitizer, turpentine, and setting things on fire. Oh, and also beautifully painted portraits. I am so excited to talk to Brian Donnelly, a fellow Canadian whose work I have admired for years. I can't wait to ask him about melting stuff, painting pink hair, and Degrassi Junior High. If you don't know what Degrassi is, you're probably not Canadian, but don't worry, Brian and I will break it down for you. Okay, let's do this. Calling Brian in Toronto. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
I like your Skype picture.
Oh, thank you.
That's, do you remember what it is?
It's quite old. It's actually from when I was working in the studio, probably in 2010, maybe.
Oh, really? Yeah, it looks like
for
you're
a show here in Toronto.
Okay, it looks like you're peeking out of that little out of the little circle. I like it. I can see one eyeball. And
yeah,
you get to look at my husband.
Yeah, that's true. I do get to see Greg here.
Yeah.
It's on my phone.
First of all. Well, you know I love your work. And thank you so much for that crazy print.
Absolutely. I felt like I was doing a really weird project, so I needed to kind of...
It is a really weird project, but it's fantastic.
I felt like it was a big risk. And, like, you had me on the blog last year, and I was so stoked about it. But I was like, I need to say thank you. Maybe it's like my Canadian-ness that I just need to thank people
and say sorry.
A friend of mine told me that, like, you're supposed to send thank you notes to everyone, and I've been trying to keep up with that.
Oh my word! I can barely get a thank you email out.
I'm not saying that I'm good at it. I'm saying that I pulled it off this time.
There you go. Well, I'm glad that it was me because I get to reap the benefits of that Canadian-ness. So from one Canadian to another, thank you for thanking me.
You're very welcome.
For thanking you. And I'm sorry. We'll just throw an I'm sorry in there somewhere too.
Oh, sorry.
So we're going to get back to talking about that project because it's super cool. But before then, if you've listened to any of the episodes, you know that I need to hear what you were like as a kid. So were you melting paintings' faces off with turpentine and hand sanitizer when you were six?
No, only a magnifying glass against all of my G.I. Joes.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Yeah? Oh, man, the melting began.
Encouraged me along the way to experiment with things, and one of those things at one point was a magnifying glass.
So. Did you set anything on fire?
Nothing of any real consequence.
That's good.
Just G.I. Joes and a few cars, small toy cars.
But okay, nothing, good.
Nothing too expensive.
Okay, good. No houses. Okay, good. So were you making art when you were a kid?
Or did that come later? I definitely was. I think my dad made me an easel when I was about two or three with paper on it. So just like a huge sheet. Well, I'm saying huge, but I remember it as a child. So it was probably an 18 by 24 pad of paper that just kind of folded over so I could paint or draw. And that was, I mean, he just encouraged me to do it. But my dad also liked building things, right? He was a woodworking man. So he liked to build. I'd say there's a good percentage of furniture in my parents' house that's actually built by my father.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is impressive, actually. I kind of, every time I go home to visit, I look at stuff and I go, wow. I feel totally inadequate. Like every time I walk in there, I'm like, I don't know how to make anything useful.
Well, you guys can partner up. He makes the easel, you make the art. Win-win.
No, we can't now. We tried, but Dad passed away a couple of years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You didn't know.
No, I didn't. Did he, what did they think of you becoming an artist when you grew up?
I think it would depend what age you're asking about.
Right.
Like age five, they would have been encouraging it 100%. I think when I was transitioning out of high school and into post-secondary, it started to become like a question, because I started taking my art classes very seriously in high school, towards the end of high school. And then I was also taking classes, like a new class in graphic design that I was also very good at in high school. So there was kind of like this feeling that I would follow up with graphic design.
Right.
And because that kind of has this, you know, a better idea of finding a job at the end of that.
Yes.
At the end of that. So I think that they were holding out for that. And I definitely tried to do it. But it really wasn't for me. And I ended up dropping out of a school because it wasn't working. I wasn't happy doing graphic design, and I'd been kind of pushed towards the arts and the totally absurd for so long that I just thought, I'm just going to do this. And when I told my parents, I feel like it was a bit of a mixed review for them. They were happy that I still wanted to go to post-secondary, but they weren't totally sold on me going to art school. It took about, I think, 8 months of me going to an arts college before they kind of realized that I was really serious about this.
Right.
Because I made something for a class that was pretty involved for somebody who wouldn't be taking something seriously. I made like a 6-foot-tall replica Bic lighter.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, it wasn't.
That sounds so cool.
Ridiculous. It didn't function, but it was sculpted cardboard at the top. So it was, I just measured everything and kind of made it work so that it had a full, like, aluminum casing at the top and the button. And I even had, it was when they first invented that childproof that they put on lighters. It's like a ring that goes around the click wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was on there, but it was broken off because everybody was breaking them off of their lighters at that point because they didn't like it. So I was very specific about that detail. And I think that was when my dad was like, this is it. This is what he's going to do. He's nuts about it.
Yeah, so, no. Well, and look, it turns out you can build things. Giant lighters.
One or two things. We did work together on part of that. He did help me kind of work out a few problems with that.
That's cool. Were you living at home when you did that?
No, I had... I would speak to my dad on the phone and talk to him about the problem. And
oh, okay.
I came home, I forget. There was some reason that I came home to visit, and I asked if we could kind of build the base together out of some light wood so that I could get it from St. Catharines, which is where my parents live, back up to Toronto. So we did. We just kind of laid it out and talked it out between the two of us one afternoon, and then we had it built.
Wow, that's so cool.
I finished the rest of the detailing in Toronto in my very, very, very small apartment.
So do you still have that Bic lighter?
I think it's actually still in my parents' house. I think I moved it back home. Oh, it was there the last time I looked.
Wow, that's awesome.
Last time I looked was probably 8 years ago.
Okay, well, it might still be down there. So where did you, so you graduated, and then you started at design school?
Yes, I did.
Where was that?
Sheridan College.
Oh, I went there too.
Did you? It didn't work out for me. I didn't do foundation or fundamentals, I think they call it, like the first year program.
Yeah.
I had managed to apply and get directly into the graphic design program right out of high school, which wow. I think was kind of a bad choice for me. I think I could have used the fundamental courses, the first year course, to help me kind of understand what post-secondary education was going to be just for me.
Yeah, it is a bit of a shocker.
I went into it really head first and essentially landed in a second year course and was in over my head It just wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
And then, where did you switch to go to art school?
I went to Ontario College of Art.
Oh. And Design,
which is now the Ontario College of Art and Design University.
That's right.
But I don't think they call it that. I think they just call it OCADU to keep it less confusing.
Yeah. That is a great school.
I actually went back a few years ago.
Oh, did you? To teach or to learn?
When I finished at OCAD before they added the U, they didn't actually offer a bachelor's degree. So a few years ago, I kind of decided that I would like to, like, they just offered an associate's degree. So I decided I would go back and just take the, like, I needed to take 5 courses to receive my bachelor's degree. So I kind of went back as a mature student. It's a really different feeling.
I was going to ask, how did that feel?
Well, you feel a little bit out of place because your priorities are totally different than most of the people around you. I'm very much paying for this out of my own pocket, and a lot of the people there are very young and don't really grasp that money concept the same way that I was grasping it at that point.
Right. And don't you find too, like, I just, because I went to UVic for my BFA right out of high school, I just wasn't old enough to, I didn't have anything to say yet. Like, I just didn't, like, I don't know. I just was so young, I hadn't really experienced anything. And I always think it'd be kind of fun to go back, you know, a little bit later just so that you also have more life experience.
Oh, absolutely. My attitude towards education was totally different while I was there. Like, I was sitting at the front of the class for the first time in my entire education experience. I was like, no, I'm paying for this. I'm going to hear every single word.
Yeah, and you probably weren't hungover either.
No, that never happened. Never hungover in class.
And so just 5 courses. So what did you do? Were you already painting? Like, had you been painting that whole time?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think I initially graduated in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would have returned in 2013 because I was doing it part-time. So these 5 courses, I was doing 1 course per semester.
Right.
Just so that I could deal with kind of working a full-time job to pay my bill.
Right.
And then go to school 1 class and continue to make work because I hadn't stopped painting at all. I was at that point doing 3 things and, like, cultivating a new romantic relationship at the time too. So,
oh my gosh,
I had an incredibly full plate and I was going in all directions and was probably a bit of a loon. So,
and you were that guy in the front of the class with your hand up.
I always, every single question, even if I was wrong.
I have more to say. So you're not a graphic designer. I wondered if you were, actually, because your work is so clean and graphic, and that was going to be one of my questions for you. So what did your day job end up being? totally not art-related.
I went in the opposite direction, and it was definitely a part of advertising, but it was a really low rung in the advertising world. It was not art-related at all for me.
What were you?
It's hard to describe what I was.
I'm just picturing you sitting in the basement.
I was on the top floor.
Oh, okay.
But I was watching commercials to verify that they were correct so that they could be delivered to television stations.
Digitally. Wow.
It sounds really funny and that it wouldn't be such a bad job, but most people who think it wouldn't be such a bad thing to do haven't watched commercials for 8 straight hours.
I know, that's usually what people skip, and you're sitting there watching them.
I was for I think about 10 years I was doing various jobs at that company. The last, I think, 5 years I was there, I was doing that job.
Wow. And were you in Toronto? So you were still in Toronto, obviously.
I was in Toronto. Yeah. This was to make ends meet in Toronto. You just kind of,
yeah,
best paying job you can get.
I worked in advertising in Toronto.
Yeah.
I wasn't watching commercials though. I worked at Taxi.
Oh, okay.
Do you know Taxi?
I had a friend who was at Taxi for a while. He's moved on now.
Let's throw it out. Who was it?
I can't. Who was at Taxi?
I know. They all kind of blend together, don't they? I was just thinking it's so weird because we've got our Sheridan overlap and now we've got advertising overlap.
And there's a few people in advertising and I'm trying to think of who was at Taxi and who was at John Street. And who
Well, and they all move around, so it doesn't really matter. Yeah. Like, they start, I know.
Because I went to OCAD, I know a lot of them from OCAD, and then I know them from kind of the working world,
right,
where I would occasionally talk to these people in agencies, because eventually you catch up and you're just running into each other.
Yeah, for sure. Well, okay, so you're watching commercials, and then you're painting at night?
No, I managed to get a job that was afternoons into the evening. So I was waking up every morning and painting all morning and then going to work.
Wow. And were you showing and stuff at the time with your work?
Yes.
Wow. And how were you doing that? Were you just like, you graduated and were you sort of, so that was what, 2003? When you graduated, and so were you, did you do the whole go around to all the galleries thing, or how did you start showing your work?
I kind of ducked down for a while after I graduated. I took a lot of time to figure out what I wanted to paint and how I wanted to approach painting. And so that kind of kept me from going around to a lot of galleries and introducing myself and being a go-getter, as they say. It just wasn't in me. I'm a little bit naturally shy, which is a bit unfortunate.
Yeah, that's most artists are. It's rare that, you know, they're like, yeah, look at my stuff. Like, that's a pretty rare artist.
It's hard to convince yourself to go out and do it, I think. So I'm having a hard time remembering how I managed to get connected. I think I had enough friends that we were doing enough shows kind of together.
Right.
At any given time, that eventually somebody just kind of recognizes you and invites you to do something. And so I was doing a few things around Toronto. My CV didn't really start expanding rapidly until a few years ago. It was kind of a slow buildup. I was definitely working very hard, but I was so caught up in the development of making painting that I just didn't worry about showing it, because I got caught up in this strange limbo of painting something, being really happy with it, starting the next thing, and then hating the last thing.
Oh, yes.
So much that I wouldn't show it to anyone, and it was a bit of a nightmare.
I have been there, and there's probably, everybody listening is probably nodding right along. They might be crying.
Sure, at least three or four people.
Yeah, at least. Well, and so, okay, were they, I have several questions. Let's see if I can, how articulate I can be here. So, say you made something, then you loved it, you made the next thing, you hated the previous thing. Were they departures from each other, or were they sort of in the same look and feel? It was just like painting by painting, or were you sort of changing your style as you went?
A lot of them would be the same look and feel, and then once things started to change, because it just kind of happens organically, you just suddenly realize you don't want to paint like this anymore, and you just start on a different path. And then you realize, well, I can't really start showing this stuff that I'm not happy with anymore, because I'm not happy with it. I don't think I could talk about it.
Right.
So I've learned to get over that. I'm far past that point in my life now where I can, I'm really happy with the work that I was doing years ago, because I mean, without that, I wouldn't be here. Right.
Right. Okay, and so in between those transitions, like from going from something to go, you know, and thinking, I'm not really happy with this, and transitioning into something else, would it be like micro changes, or would you be like, this is out the door, I'm doing something completely different?
It would be micro changes.
Yeah.
It would be small things that would kind of drive it in a direction. And then once I could kind of clearly see, you know, the next patch of ice in the ocean, I would just jump.
Right.
Once you make the jump, you kind of sever.
Yeah.
You give up on things.
Yeah, for sure. And so when did you start doing the work that you're doing now?
The turpentine work was a long process of development that actually started in 2010-ish.
Okay.
2010, 2011. And then it didn't really start coming together and becoming something I understood until, I think, 20, maybe 13 or 14.
Was Were you really working on that at OCAD?
No, no. I was working on it while I was in school.
Yeah.
But I wasn't taking any courses that were studio courses while I was at OCAD. It was specifically academic courses.
Got it. So that you could get the.
Yeah, just so I could finish.
Gotcha. Okay.
Academic.
But so you were, yeah, when you were painting, that's sort of what you were developing. Okay. I have to, like, what day was it when you were like, you know what? I think I'm going to pour some turpentine on this beautiful painting. Was it an accident, or like, why did you do it? And like, yeah, tell me all the stuff.
I think it was, I don't know that there was a specific day. I think I was kind of looking at the work that I had been doing up to a point in 2011. I was doing these figure paintings, nude figures, life-size, with animal heads painted over top of their faces.
Ooh, I love those.
It was a stretch of work that went, I think, from like 2005 until 2011. And around 2011, I just kind of thought, this has run its course, and it's no longer saying what I want it to say anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be a little bit more aggressive, and I wanted it to be a little bit more about visual information getting lost than it was. I mean, with the figurative work, it really started to be about the figures having animal heads, and it wasn't about me making paintings and deliberately painting over them. I thought it was going to translate really easily, kind of like the way you would see, like, remember your textbooks in high school, and somebody would always draw genitalia on something with a ballpoint pen.
I sure do.
I really wanted that work to be in that same kind of light, to look deliberately vandalized.
Right.
But it didn't come across the same way. I mean, the audience is always going to see what they want to see. There's no getting away from that. So I kind of decided that I needed to change the way things were going, and I wanted it to be a bit more aggressive, and I wanted it to be more about loss than it was about the figure. So I just kind of grabbed a hold of it and started going, what can I do to make this happen? How can I make this more aggressive? And
wow, you figured it out.
One thing happens or another thing happens, and you just kind of come home angry one day, and you're like, but you've had a bad day, and you just start thinking, this work isn't working anymore. And I thought, I wonder what would happen if I just hose this off the canvas. Is there a way for me to do it? And that's kind of when it started to cog and really work. Like, what would it take to get this to come off the canvas, but still leave a mark to very much look like it was supposed to be on the canvas, and then it just fell off. So for it to leave the kind of trail that it was leaving, I mean, this was, and I say it was 2 years developing that, it really was. There's a notebook here in my studio that's full of like trial and error on all kinds of different solvents, from, you know, nail polish remover to oven cleaner.
Oh, was that kind of fun?
I mean, it's
slash
fun.
Toxic.
But it's super toxic.
Yeah.
The other end of it is you realize very quickly that you need a spray booth to do these things, and you need to invest in a mask, and you can't just do this randomly. You can't just show up with all these solvents and be like, this will be fine.
Oh my word. Oh my gosh. And so you figured out, I'm just picturing it. So what you now use is turpentine and hand sanitizer?
That's right.
That's kind of scary that hand sanitizer can do that.
Hand sanitizer is alcohol based. So, I mean, if you ever spill something on, you know, your clothes, you can use hand sanitizer to get a lot of things out.
Wow.
It's actually very abrasive. So it'll work quite well to remove almost anything. Wow. But it also, like, because of its kind of jelly quality, that's specifically why I use it, because it'll work with the turpentine. This turpentine itself is really low viscosity.
Oh, right.
Low viscosity or high viscosity? Anyway.
Some kind of viscosity.
It branches out very quickly. So instead of moving straight down like a bead of water, it kind of hits the canvas and spreads.
Oh,
wide.
Right.
A bit blurry and bushy on the sides rather than being a straight kind of line downward. So the hand sanitizer mixed with the turpentine, and this is like mixing, you know, an oil and vinegar salad dressing. You really have to shake this to use it. Because they don't want to mix. Oil the alcohol and the water and the hand sanitizer won't really blend with the turpentine properly.
This is so weird. I love it.
It's so bizarre, and it took me so long to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, no kidding. I love the thought of that little notebook was like, no, it's like a mad scientist. No, this will never work. Nail polish remover, no.
It was a little bit mad scientist. Like, it's full of notes about what happens, what the results are on doing that, and why it won't work and why it will, and the pros and cons of everything about it.
Oh, my gosh.
Oven cleaner was a disaster.
What happened?
Oven cleaner just doesn't really do anything to paint. I thought it would really destroy stuff, but it just doesn't.
What about nail polish remover?
No, the acetone just isn't, it just isn't hard enough to take things. Well, it'll take things off, but it needs a bit of rubbing
right.
in order to do it. So if you're going to remove nail polish, you always do it with like a cotton ball or something.
Right.
It won't just fall off your finger.
True.
So it didn't really have a lot of effect on the paint. And I was a bit disappointed because I really thought it was going to be nail polish remover.
Yeah,
but
you'd think.
But it turned out to be turpentine, which is also super toxic.
So tell me now you have a mask and some sort of ventilation system.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, good.
I spend hundreds of dollars on new filters every year for my mask.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that.
And half the day with a mask on my face some days.
Okay, well, here's my other question. Now, I don't want you to give away all your secrets, but so you can tell me if you don't want to answer these. But do you paint their beautiful faces and then, like, really take it off? Or
yes.
Oh, that's what I thought the first time I saw them. I was like, because what?
It's about commitment for me.
Yeah.
It's all the way or don't do it.
Yeah, because if it's about loss and loss of information, that information has to be there in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let me ask this then. This is the girl who's like, you know, spent years staring at blank canvases and not doing anything because I was so afraid of like wrecking something. So you've painted, because you're, I'm going to do a great big post so that everybody can see what we're talking about. But the rest of the painting, like the hair and, you know, it's so beautifully done and so much detail. So, okay, so you've done the whole painting. It's all beautiful. And now here comes the hand sanitizer and turpentine. At that point, can you wreck it? Like if it doesn't pour the way you want it to pour, or do you have to just, you know,
the paint has to still be pretty wet when you approach this. You can't let everything dry.
Right.
So things have to be kind of a certain way. And I usually know how much is going to get removed. So there are areas that will be dry. Like the hair will most times be totally dry, and it would take a lot more effort to get it to come off.
But wait, what if the turpentine, by the way, we need to brand whatever this goo is called, like the Donnelly solution or something, TM. But
I don't know if it's a solution anyway.
A goo. What if it goes all the way off the bottom of the canvas and you didn't want it to do that?
Do you mean if the whole image comes off?
Well, if it just doesn't pour the way you want it to, or it's like, what if one of the little trickles goes left?
You can always do it again. I mean, the joy of turpentine is that if you put enough of it onto a wet painting, you can take the whole thing off if you really want to.
True. Okay, because that's what I was picturing.
If I don't get a result, a result that I'm happy with, I can take the entire thing off and start again.
Whoa.
But you can only do that once or twice before you've really compromised the entire surface.
Right.
Because I'm also big into surface. So you stare at those blank canvases and you you just don't know where to begin. And I stare at those blank canvases and I don't know if I should start, because I've also spent a couple of weeks preparing canvas. So I'm really big into like my surface. So I'm, you know, sizing and lining and doing something like 10 layers of gesso, 50-50 watt. And like just very carefully laying out what I want to build the surface. So I'm using up a huge amount of time just to make a surface, because I'm really into what my product is in the end. So you need the right surface.
Wow.
Sometimes I look at these surfaces and I think, this is it. It's done.
Yeah.
Because I sand in between coats of gesso, and I've had some that have come across so smooth at the end, I'm not sure if it's still a canvas or if it's like a piece of bathroom tile.
Wow.
It's so perfect. So it's hard to paint on those.
Yeah. So do you have that little freak out moment, or you must?
No, not anymore.
No.
I've gotten very used to kind of letting go.
Yeah.
Just kind of accepting. Like sometimes paintings don't work. I've got one in the studio now that's not going to work. And I'm going to have to take it off the stretcher and move on. And, you know, I put a good couple of weeks into prepping that canvas, and it's not going to work anymore. So I have to get rid of it.
Does that make you mad, or are you just like, okay, here we go, next?
No, I mean, you get a little bit angry when you realize something isn't working the way you planned, but that's life.
Yeah, I know. I love it when you get to that point, you know. I feel like with my art, I finally got into that point, you know, where it's like, okay, where it used to, if that would happen, which of course it always did, then I just wouldn't make anything for months, if not longer.
Right. I once asked Robert Bateman that question.
Really?
You know, the nature artist.
Yeah, yeah,
Robert.
Yeah.
He was giving an artist talk somewhere north of Toronto. I can't remember where it was. And I went to it because I happened to be in that small town like that day. And he was doing a talk at their center. And I was just figuring out this process for myself of disrupting visual information. And so I just put my hand up during the Q&A and I said, what do you do when a painting doesn't work? How many paintings do you destroy a year? Because most artists will. They'll just take it off the stretcher and shred it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work. But he's so prolific. He makes so much work that I had to know.
Yeah.
He really didn't appreciate that question. He looked at me like I had three arms growing out of my face when I asked that question.
Really?
He said, I don't destroy anything. I don't have time to destroy anything. He said, I once took a painting that was on wood through a bandsaw because it was too wide, because the composition wasn't going to work. So I took about 6 inches off of one side of it. He's like, that's the only thing I've ever... I was a little bit shocked at that. I was a little bit shocked that he hasn't really destroyed many works. But then again, it kind of makes sense for him to produce as much as he does. I don't think he can really afford to make mistakes.
No. Wow. And that's kind of stressful.
I'll just never forget the look on his face.
Yeah.
It was my favorite thing. Like, I think I've managed to make this man very angry somehow.
Well, there you go. Your day in a small town, and you broke part of them. There you go. Congratulations. Well, I love the story of like Monet doing his water lilies and all of the canvases that got thrown out and painted over. And like, that's kind of liberating to know, because, you know, you just assume that these masters just like get up in the morning and like create masterpieces and then go for a coffee. And it's just so nice to hear that, you know, things get thrown out. Like, not everything works. Well, unless you're Robert Bateman.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes things have to be changed in order to work. I mean, there's that Courbet painting, L'Origin du Monde, The Origin of the World.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we all know that painting.
Yes.
But that's a segment of a larger painting.
Oh.
It wasn't actually just a painting of a woman's genitalia. It was discovered a few years ago. Like, somebody did the scientific research on a painting that was found in like an antique store, and it's her face. The rest of the woman. Well, not what? The rest. It's just like her head. So he separated two pieces, her genitalia and her face.
Wow.
And made them into two different paintings. And one was because I think because the collector who ended up buying The Origin of the World was just into erotica. So he kind of just separated it, restretched it, and sold it as that.
Wow. This
sometimes you can do that.
Yeah, there you go. Who knew? This is turning into a really cool art history class.
My high school art teacher was very into art history.
Oh, I love, like, that is my favorite thing when you get an art history teacher who tells you, like, those little stories.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care about, like, the, you know, the Wikipedia version. I love all of that. And did you know? Those are my favorite things.
I will look for the, I think there was an article in The Guardian about it, because that discovery was just made a couple of years ago.
Okay, yeah, I'll put it in, if you can find it, I'll put it in the bottom of the post.
I'll go and search for it, and I'll send you a link.
Okay, that's awesome. Thank you.
I remember reading it and going, I've always wondered if this was a larger painting, because it's such a strange thing to just paint. I mean, I remember doing it once myself. I actually approached it and was like, well, Courbet is a great painter. I've always been a fan. Maybe I'll make my own. It's not a really popular thing to do. People don't really respond super well.
And so now you're doing the heads, and people love those.
Yeah, they seem to respond to that a lot better.
Well, it depends where you show it, probably, but...
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Or depending on what your collectors are into, I suppose.
There's also that. That's also, like, a big part of it. I definitely have a few collectors in the past who've always preferred my figurative nude work.
Oh.
And who are particularly interested in this. And you can read it, like, when you're having a conversation with them. They're not interested in, you know, this work. And that's okay.
Yeah.
That's everybody's...
Well, and is it the figure or is it the colors? Because the color palettes are quite different with those series.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the color or what's happening, but I often think that a lot of people are just into, you know, nude work, and that's what they collect, and that's okay. If that's what you're collecting, build that collection.
Right.
Because someone's going to want to see it one day in its entirety.
Right.
It'll be a great traveling show.
I did this series of collages way back, like before I, you know, really knew what I was doing at all. And not that I do now, but, you know, and I was doing these like Playboy, like vintage Playboy pinup things.
Yeah.
And anyway, we had them, there's six of them in the series, and I had them in our downstairs hallway. And I did them when my son was really little. And then he turned about seven. He was like, mommy, when my friends come over, he's like, could you please put those paintings somewhere else? And so I was, and my parents, my mom's an artist, so we had lots of, like, you know, it was the 70s for crying out loud. So we had all sorts of nudes around our house. And I just remember being mortified when my friends would come over. So I said, yeah, buddy, I'll move that upstairs. So it's up in our room so that none of his friends need to see it and be more. But I said, you'll probably have more friends that want to come over. Can we go to Charlie's house?
Actually you're going to be running a different kind of show.
That's exactly, yeah. So
all
anyway.
They're knocking at your door.
I know. The boys are almost all 11 now. So I'm like, you know what? Let's tuck these things away, shall we? Anyway. So you said earlier that that nude series were life size, right?
Yeah.
And so how big are the ones that you're doing now? Like the heads, the melty heads?
They range, between about a foot square to about 4 feet square.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
I got really into the square for a while. I don't know if Instagram's the influence on that or what, but
I love a good square too.
To work.
Do you like working on the bigger ones or the smaller ones?
They're both very different animals.
Yeah.
The bigger ones are a lot more work in one sense, but at the same time, like, they can be a lot of fun to work on because you get to understand all the details you're doing differently.
Right. And it must be quite physical too, trying to get this stuff, like to do the turpentine stuff on a bigger.
Yeah, it's a bit of an effort. I mean, I have to move it to a different part of the studio so that it can be properly ventilated.
Right.
Problematic. But it's not the end of the world.
And so you have a separate studio now, so that you're not there's no fumes in where you live.
Oh, no, there's fumes where I live.
Oh. Is your studio in your house or is it somewhere else?
My studio is in my house. It is. My partner and I are very lucky to have quite a large apartment in Parkdale in Toronto.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So we have a lot of space. So I've just separated off. We have this extra storage room. So I've separated that storage room off with its own ventilation.
Oh, good.
And we just move things down there. And both of us are artists, so she can move her. She does a lot of drawing work that'll need to be fixed. And she's doing painting as well. And we both varnish down there now.
Oh, okay. So. Okay, good. We've got ventilation and masks for everybody. I don't have to worry about
ventilation, separate room, masks for everybody.
Okay,
took
good.
To figure out that I needed all these things, but when I figured it out, boy, did I go for it.
did you figure it out when you woke up from being like passed out from fumes and you're like, I'm going to have to buy a mask?
Yes. Pretty much. Yeah. I woke up. It was when I was living in a smaller apartment, I actually realized I was going to need to do this because I was working with a medium, liquid medium, which is, it's got a fume. I left some out overnight and I woke up and left the house at 8 o'clock in the morning and felt like I was drunk.
Oh, like my God.
A bit off, not like NyQuil drunk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Been crushing cough syrup all night, and so I decided that it was time to make a change.
So that was a really good decision.
So that didn't keep happening because I couldn't deal with that. So.
Oh my God. Okay, yeah, that's a very good decision. So I have a few more questions for you, and then we're doing not so speedy speed round. But I want to get into detail about a couple of your pieces. But I want to know about your hair, not your hair. On your head, but unless you want to talk about that, you're more than welcome to. But the hair in your paintings is so, like, I just love, like, the bands. And is there a reason, or do you just love, like, it's just so, I don't know, I could look at it forever.
It didn't actually start happening that way until 2014. Like, that style of painting hair that way, I didn't really get into it until late in 2014 on a painting that I was working on for a show in San Francisco. The painting was called Fountain of Youth, and it's a woman with a blonde woman with bangs and a ponytail.
Oh, yes, I know that one, yep.
And that was the first time the hair kind of came together really well, and I got really into it. And I think that it was just the kind of flow of the brush for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of found my zen, I guess we can call it that, in it. And I just got so into it that I couldn't stop painting that way. Before, I would be a lot more rushed about hair. And so if you see pieces from before that painting, the hair is very different. It's not nearly as polished. And I just got so interested in it that I couldn't I couldn't do it any other way. I just, every time I approached it again, I would do it again and again.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's one of my favorite parts. I mean, I love that the faces are wiped away, but I could just look at it forever. And so do you work from photographs, or is that out of your head? Or like how, because there's, one has a tattoo on their head that's shaved away, and there's rainbow hair, and there's like a top knot that's pink. And so is that just,
yeah. I go out and I meet people and try to photograph people. So I do work from photographs because I don't think I could put anyone through sitting in a room with me while I deal with my own creative process.
Right.
I don't think anyone deserves that. But I try to meet with people, especially people who have interesting hair now, because hair so often ends up being what's left in my work.
Yeah.
To have interesting hair is more fun for me to paint.
And are they people that you know, or are they just strangers?
A lot of them are strangers.
Wow. And do you end up showing them the work after?
Oh, yeah, always. Always.
That's so cool.
A lot of people are really interested to see. I mean, because I'm very upfront about what I do with people, I always say, this is how I paint. Like, I'd like to paint you, but this is how I paint. So if you're not comfortable with it, don't say yes.
Right, because you're going to have no face.
Yeah. Not the kind of thing you want to send to your mother just right away. Like, she might be a little bit upset about it.
Yeah.
Your mother spent 9 months making that face happen.
That's right. I'm just, but you spent 2 years figuring how to get it off. So, you know.
Yeah.
No, it works out. That would be so cool. I've got the most boring hair, but now, like, I'm like, well, put a little pink in there and
sometimes
maybe.
Boring hair is inadvertently interesting. I did a like a shaved head bald man last year that I loved because I didn't really have to paint hair. I had to figure out what does stubble on this level look like.
Right.
How do you paint stubble? And it's just problem solving for me. It's just how I approach painting, I think.
It's
the best way to solve the problem.
And do you, because it does seem very meditative, especially like hearing that, do you like it to be quiet or do you put on music or what's going on?
It's a range of things in my studio. I've taken to listening to books on tape a lot.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to read more, but I just don't have the time to sit and read books. So if I can listen to a book, it makes things easier.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I'll listen to the CBC in the morning. I really like CBC in the morning. But right up until after the show that's on after Q most days. And then I'm kind of out.
Yeah.
I'll check out after that. And then music occasionally. I'll go to iTunes and it'll usually be something most people wouldn't listen to.
I was just wondering if you, like, some people say they just... they get too distracted, but I would think that if you're doing something kind of meditative, like a book would be great just to listen to the story and do your thing.
Absolutely. Sometimes that can be the best thing, which is also why talk radio works.
Right.
Because it's just kind of like you're absorbing thought while you're going.
Right.
I find music can be a little bit, it depends what I'm working on. For music, it'll be when I'm really trying to get something done. If I'm really trying to hammer out work for a deadline.
Yeah. What kind of music is it?
It's a lot of metal.
I was gonna ask if that's what it was when you said hammer it out. I'm like, I think it's
I have a soft spot for the metal music.
I would love to. I could just be a fly on the wall with my mask on. It would be fun to watch. I was gonna ask you. Speaking of breaking up your day, sorry, what were you gonna say?
I'm not even sure anymore.
Okay. I interrupted you
too much. I'm sure it was just about metal, and I was going to go off on a tangent about heavy metal music. So,
well, I grew up in small town Canada in the 80s, so I know
You know all about it.
I know all about it. I dated all of the boys who loved it. I was going to ask when you were saying about, your day, about, doing stuff in the morning till after Q. So are you a full-time artist now, or do you still have a day job?
I don't have a day job. I was packaged out, as they say. Just over a year ago. Yeah.
And were you kind of like, okay, fine, universe?
I was ready to go.
Yeah.
I was ready to leave full-time employment. Painting was really picking up and starting to take over a lot of my day. And it was all I would think about while I was at work.
Yeah.
And I kind of, the job that I was doing was becoming obsolete because we were acquired. My company was acquired by a larger company in the U.S.
Mm.
So they kind of already had a department that did what I did.
Yeah.
They didn't really need me. they decided, maybe it was, we had a couple meetings and we talked about the future, and I said, I'm not adverse to going. Not a problem for me. But they knew this. I was very open with kind of my employer.
Yeah. And so do you think there's any looking back, like, or it's just, this is it now. Not that you would go back to a job like that, but like.
Well, I mean, I think as an artist, you're always going to worry about a steady stream of income.
Yeah, I know.
You try to figure out, how am I going to make this work if I'm really going to do this? And I'm definitely going to try for it.
Yeah.
Definitely push, and I'm going to work hard. And there's still, you know, money for me to survive on right now. And the paintings are still selling. There's still a collector base out there who want the work. So I'm going to push as hard as I can, because I feel like, you know, those people who bought those paintings from me as I was coming along, while I was still working, they were buying into, you know, who I was going to be. As much as they were, you know, loving the work, they were also, you know, handing me an opportunity. Every time someone buys a painting, they're handing you that opportunity to move on and keep painting, keep working, keep making art, because they want you to. They want you to do it.
I love that.
You owe them a little bit to keep doing it. So if you, every time somebody goes nuts and quits painting mid-career,
yeah,
breaking hearts across the board because a bunch of people really believe in you. So.
I love that. I'm going to remember that every time I want to quit.
You can't quit.
I know.
You can, but I mean, I don't think about it. Every once in a while, you think about quitting. And every time I think about it, I go, well, what would you do instead?
Yeah.
And I think, oh, man, nothing.
Yeah, no kidding.
Get really good at watching Netflix.
Yeah. I could actually be quite good at that.
I'm actually really good at it. I would hate that I'm good at it.
I know. And if somebody could pay me to eat chips and dip, like, that would be the best, actually.
I think it would depend on the dip.
Yeah.
I'm really into Greek yogurt as a dip right now.
With something in it, I hope.
With specifically sour cream and onion chips. No, just yogurt.
Just the yogurt?
2% plain Greek yogurt and dip sour cream and onion chips. I can't get enough. I don't know why.
Oh my God, I'm going to try that. My big thing lately has been plain ripple chips with dill pickle dip.
Wow, that's bold.
Thank you. See, now I just need someone to write me a check, and I'd be all set. Okay, I could literally.
I'm not a person who loves pickles, so I can't really. I mean, I like.
I don't like pickles. You could not pay me to eat a pickle. But dill pickle dip. I just work away around the chunks of pickle. I don't eat the left behind in the dip container is just a whole bunch of little chunks of pickle. I'm giving way too much information about myself here, but I can feel the judging from the listeners who aren't even listening yet because we're just recording this now. But anyway, I'm going to stop talking about dill pickle dip.
Well, there's going to be a pickle podcast that calls you and wants to know what your problem is.
Oh, you're right. Oh, man.
There's going to be a whole thing now. It's going to be a war.
Well, I always tell my son, you know, you have to try everything. And he loves pickles. And he's like, Mommy, why don't you just eat a pickle on them? Because they're disgusting.
Yeah.
But you have to try everything.
I will eat them, but I won't. I'm not into it as much as some people are. I've watched people just crush half a jar of pickles watching TV.
Oh,
and
God. Like,
what are you doing?
No. I won't do it. But I am going to try your sour cream and onion Greek yogurt. It's actually making my mouth water a little bit.
It used to be sour cream instead of Greek yogurt, but, I mean, that catches up with you pretty fast.
And they taste exactly the same.
Your metabolism changes.
I know.
Oh, yeah, it totally tastes exactly the same. It's fine. So I've started doing that, and it's the chips, though. Now it's the chips. You can't just eat half a tub of sour cream, man. Now you can't eat a whole bag of chips.
I know, it's the worst thing about aging. I see we're kindred spirits. I knew it. Okay, so I need to ask you about the print that you sent me. How do you pronounce the title of that?
La Pucelle?
Yeah, what does that mean?
La Pucelle means the maid.
Okay.
Maid is what Joan of Arc would have called herself.
Okay.
So this is a reference to Joan of Arc.
Okay. And
because Joan of Arc was burned at the stake at age 19. So
I didn't know she was only 19.
She was only 19. Yeah. True.
Oh my goodness.
31, I think, was the year. I only know this because I got a book on tape about Joan of Arc.
Well, there you go. So you painted the original, and then tell everybody what you did with it.
I set it on fire on April 2nd, 2017.
Just this year?
Yeah.
Like 2 weeks ago. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so you set it on fire down to ashes.
Yep.
And then how many prints?
19.
Because she was 19. God, you're smart. And then you signed you numbered them with the ashes from the original.
They're signed and numbered in glue, and then ashes are sprinkled over top of it to solidify in the glue.
Dude, that's deep.
And then it's fixed, sprayed with a fixative so that it won't come off.
And I have one.
You do? I sent you a proof. I got a couple of proofs when I had the prints made.
That's so smart. So when did you hatch this plan?
I've been kind of thinking about multiples and how to deal with the idea of the multiple in my work.
Yeah.
And part of it's just, you know, moving on to being a full-time artist, you start to think, well, what are my options, you know, to make a bit more money doing other things? And making archival prints of things, limited edition prints, is one thing that a lot of artists do. And I was just thinking about how that works for me. And because my work is so heavily based on it being the original when it gets destroyed or you know, modified.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say anything's really destroyed. I don't really think that they are. But because it's so heavily based on that, I sometimes wonder if making a print is the right way to go. So I was kind of grappling with how I make a multiple, but also make a multiple the original. How do I make a multiple more than just a multiple?
Yeah, a meaningful multiple.
Yeah. So this was about, I guess I started thinking about it at the beginning of the year, or just before. And then I was offered this show here in Toronto by a friend of mine who was opening a new space and kind of asked if I wanted to do something. And I said, I'm not really sure, you know, what I want to show right now. Because I was doing so much of this turpentine work, that I'm trying to kind of expand beyond the turpentine work because mm-hmm. I need to figure out every avenue of this. So he said, I don't want the turpentine work. So I want you to do something. Because he knows that I keep a notebook where I just kind of write down every idea that I have. If I have an idea, there's a notebook in my back pocket, and I'll just write down the idea really quickly, what it is. And then I'll come back to it in a couple of days and go, well, this is a stupid idea. I'm not going to do it. Or I'll go, well, maybe there's something to this. And I'll think it out a little bit more. And he said, no, I want something from the notebook. Because he knows me well enough.
Yeah. He knows it's in that back pocket.
I have all these weird ideas that I will never do. Well, not never do. It's just that I, you know, opportunity doesn't always come up to take a risk.
Right.
In a gallery situation. So he said he wanted to take the risk, and I was excited that somebody wanted to take a risk. So I thought about it. And so the show we're doing now is called Original Copy, which is its own kind of oxymoron.
Yeah.
Very funny to me.
Yeah, I love it. Was that in the notebook?
Yeah, those words were actually mm-hmm. in the notebook. But it was, so there's two pieces in that show, technically. There's this print, and there's another painting that has been generation copied out of existence. So it's a painting and then 38 subsequent copies of it that slowly degrade into nothing.
Ooh. What's the name of the gallery?
It's called Unlovable here in Toronto.
Ah.
The bar beneath it called Unlovable. So they have Unlovable Gallery on top of it.
Oh, I love it. And so the show's up right now?
It is. It's up right now.
Until when?
Until the end of April.
End of April. Okay. So April 2nd is when you burned it. Is that when she was killed, or is...
No, she was executed in May, I
Okay.
think. But I wasn't going to push the dates.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering, if it was lined up for when.
Because, well, I mean, because I had the idea to burn a painting, but I hadn't decided who the painting would be of until kind of too late to change all the dates.
Right, right.
Because when you, I mean, the kind of other side of the coin when you set work on fire with the portrait is that everybody kind of asks you who the portrait is of.
Right.
So if I just kind of, you know, do a portrait of myself and set it on fire, it's not so bad. But not a lot of people want to hang a picture of me in their house. The other end of it is, like, at the end of the day, you might want to sell a couple of things.
Oh, yeah, selling things, right. There's that.
So I kind of, I did some thinking on it, and I thought I was thinking about witch trials and things like that, and people who get burned alive. But I also didn't want to kind of misrepresent people. And I thought, who's a character in history who has to suffer this? And then I started thinking about religious relics. This kind of popped into my head. You know, those, they always have these things in churches, like the finger bone of some saint, or, you know, somebody's pelvis bone or whatever, pelvic bone. They always have these things. And they're just fragments of human beings that are in all these different kind of churches all over the place. And I thought, that's an interesting thing, because, I mean, Joan wasn't, she wasn't sainted until, I think, 500 years after she died.
Wow.
So there's no remnants of her. I mean, she was burned to nothing. So I thought it would be really funny to kind of have this translate that way as well. So these ashes become 19 relics in their own way. At least I think.
So good.
So that's its own kind of twist up. And then to use Joan, I thought, well, Joan's kind of a great topic right now. I mean, essentially, like, her charge in the end, when it finally came down to, we're going to execute you, the charge was effectively that she refused to dress like a woman. The heresy that she was guilty of was that she had a haircut like a man and she wore men's clothes. And so they burned her alive.
Well, can you blame them?
I mean, yeah.
You know? Wow, yeah, that is incredibly timely.
Sadly. Seemed relevant. And I just needed it to be a relevant character. But then Joan ends up being so much more than that. And I also didn't want it to be directly, like, I'm doing a painting of Joan of Arc. I wanted to be a little bit more kind of sly about that. Not sly, but, you know, I didn't want it to be the main point of the piece. The point for me is about the transfer of authenticity and how to make an image become something else.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just an image. This is also, like, its own work of art.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I love about it. There's just so many layers, and it's just all so interesting. I'm so glad that I could have you on to actually, like, talk about it in your own words, because it's just, there's so many little extra things. And if I just wrote a post about it, I wouldn't do it justice. So it's so much nicer to have you talk about it. Did anybody take a video of you burning this thing?
Yes, well, there is a video. My partner and I, we kind of took this down the street, down close to the lake, to burn it. And I had her shoot it while I held it.
Mm-hmm.
So she made a video with her phone while shooting stills on a camera.
Oh my gosh.
So she.
Handy to be with another artist.
I don't think I could do half of the things that I managed to get done without the help of Marnie White. So.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, that, you know, there's a theme developing. You realize that, right? You're melting G.I. Joes. You made a big Bic lighter. You're melting off people's faces, and now you're burning stuff.
There's a consistent, like, melt fire.
Burn.
I might have to go to therapy.
Yeah, I was going to say, we might have to do a quick little intervention after this. That's fine. It's fine. Well, that segues perfectly into the next thing. I had not seen these before until I was snooping around on your site before we talked. There's a couple of pieces called reliquaries, which, beautiful segue from what you were just talking about. Are those pins?
Yeah.
They're awesome.
That was actually that was a project from a few years ago, which I thought of as, I think I was watching a documentary about religious relics and things like that. And I thought, what are the things that they keep them in called? Because a lot of them have their own glass case.
Right.
That, you know, gilt, gold, ridiculousness all around it. And I wanted to know what that was called, and then it's called a reliquary. Well, I guess the multiple of a reliquary is reliquaries. So I thought, how do I transfer this into painting? Because I think part of my creative process when I'm thinking about things is to start with a painting and then transfer it into something else. So I thought, how does this work with painting? And then I thought, okay, well, I could break this down into their own kind of casing. How do I get a small fragment of a painting into a casing? And then I realized, well, buttons, I think I was looking at my own jacket. There's, you know, some, I think there's a Mammoth Grinder, a heavy metal band.
Of course, yeah.
A Mammoth Grinder button on my jacket. And I thought, that could work. And I then started pricing button machines online. How do I make pins? How do I make this work? And so I took some research as well. I have to use the thinnest paper that I can find in order to punch these. And then I started making these really small paintings and selling them really quickly in order to fundraise to buy a button maker so that I could try this. So just so I could see if this project was going to work. And so I fundraised. And I've actually been thinking about coming back to this. Idea.
I think you should. I think they're so cool.
It looks great, but my kind of ultimate destination for that work is to sell the pins individually.
I was just going to say that. I was like, I'm going to let him finish what he's saying, and then so I don't interrupt him, and then I'm going to say you should sell them off individually.
It's a difficult thing to convince people to be a part of, though, because what I'm asking it to do is I've fragmented the work, and then I want it to scatter.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting, because then, you know, can you find out in 10 years if you can get everybody back together? Can you get it back together? Is it possible? Like, somebody's going to wear one of these on their jacket, like, in the winter, and it's going to get ruined. And, I mean, that's a given. That's going to happen somewhere along the line. Things are going to happen that are going to wreck these pins. One of them might come out of the case and just be a loose piece of paper. So that was the plan. So the two that are on the site were the first two that I did, the only two that I've actually done that were any good.
Yeah.
there were a few tests where I was like, oh no, this isn't going to work at all.
There's something there.
Well, those are only about 18 by 24. And so I wanted to do like one very large one. So if I could do one that's, you know, 5 feet tall by, you know, 5 feet wide.
Yeah. You still have your button machine?
Yeah, it's still here. I'm not getting rid of it.
No.
I put too much money into it.
Yeah, no
they're,
kidding.
They're ridiculously expensive.
Yeah. Well, I did. I played around with doing a series like that too, where I took some of my paintings, put them on pins. So I had three different designs,
okay.
Sent them to somebody, probably paid way too much money to have them made into like 300 pins. And then I was going to do a piece where I put them all onto one, like they were slightly different colors. So then it would create like another picture.
Right. Okay.
It was awesome in my notebook. It did not work. But I now have hundreds and hundreds of these pins in a box in my studio. So when I saw those on your site, I was like, oh, those are pins for sure. Because I had tried to go down a road similar, but not nearly as well executed. So that's why I was like, we need to talk about those. So you keep writing in your notebook because there's something.
Yeah. The notebook is very important.
It is.
There's something of a logistical nightmare with making that work, though. Like, because if you want to sell them individually, I mean, that's fine, but I'd really, like, if you're talking about, because if I were to do a 5-foot by 5-foot version of this, it would be hundreds of pins.
Yeah.
To make one image. And so that's a logistical nightmare for a gallery to handle the sales of that.
True. Okay, why don't you sell the big one as one piece? And then I don't have a solution for you, but, you know, you came up with this whole Joan thing, which was brilliant. So maybe there's a way to recreate and blah, blah, blah. And then you sell those pieces.
Oh, yeah.
That didn't help you at all, but I'm just going to...
There's probably a way around it. I'm still kind of thinking it out.
Yeah.
But I'm lucky. I mean, I'm lucky that most of the galleries that I'm working with now are willing to take these kind of risks with me.
Yeah.
I think I get to deal with a lot of great people, like Stephanie Jeffis in Portland.
Yeah.
She's just like, I think she took a big risk by just asking me to kind of jump in on the very first thing we worked on together, which was that show in San Francisco that I did the Fountain of Youth for, the painting of the woman with the ponytail. That was the very first thing we worked on together.
Wow. And, was she in San Francisco at the time?
Or did she have... No, I think she was living in Portland then.
Okay.
But she was curating the show with Modern Eden.
Okay.
She asked me to be a part of it, and I said, absolutely. I wasn't going to turn down that opportunity.
Yeah.
And she's into it. I think she gets where I'm coming from. So I'm lucky that she's willing to kind of take these risks with me. I don't know if I'm ready to pitch pins like on that scale to her, because I just don't think, I don't know. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll call her tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, yeah. I love that. But the seed is planted, and there's something really cool. And I mean, I love listening to you talk about all this work and just the thought. And like, you know, I love that it took you 2 years of experimenting to come up with what's working for you now. And like, who knows, in 2 years, this might turn into something, or tomorrow when you phone her.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Okay. Well, that's another good segue. So, galleries that you're working with. So do you have any shows or anything that you're working on now or anything coming up?
Things are just starting to slow down for me for the summer, which is kind of great because I need a little bit of time. I'm working on one thing for, there's a group show that I'm doing in San Francisco. No, it's not San Francisco. It's in California, though, with Venison Magazine.
Oh.
Who I did an interview with years ago. It must have been 2014. And it was a great interview, and they were kind of like, we're putting together a show of everybody who was in the magazine during our first year, whatever it was. I was like, absolutely. It was such a great interview.
Yeah.
I couldn't say no. So I'm working on something new for them. I'm kind of doing another experiment with, I'm going to turn a portrait into confetti.
Oh my gosh. When do you set it on fire?
Well, it won't be on fire. It'll just be with a hole punch.
But, you know,
a hole punch a painting into small dots and then present the dots.
Back in order or in a little pile?
I don't know yet. I haven't really decided.
See, and then now what I'm picturing is you with a magnifying glass burning it.
I mean, that would seem like the logical next step.
Sure, right? Little G.I. Joe right beside the pile. Just sets it all. When is that show?
I think it's in late summer. I don't have my calendar out in front of me right now.
I'm going to just keep watching all of this and we'll see. Like, it's so exciting to see what's coming.
I'm also lining up another solo with Stephanie Chappell.
In Portland?
In November.
Okay.
So, which is good because, I mean, now that there's like a little bit of time, now that I've like almost finished up with original copy, we still have an artist talk to do on the 22nd. But I get a little bit of time to think about what that solo show is really going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because last year was great. Last year was a great opportunity to kind of bring that work out and show it as a group in the U.S. for the first time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to disappoint And Portland's such a great city. They're so receptive.
Yeah.
To everything. It's like they like just hunger for new ideas and exciting stuff. They're really, it's an interesting city of people.
It so is. I love Portland.
Get to show there. Every time I get to show there, I'm so excited.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah, I love Portland. It'd be cool. I was there last November. Too bad I'll have to figure out a reason to come back. Go see that. Oh, and actually, I'm coming to Toronto in July.
Oh, no kidding.
Maybe we should grab a coffee.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Are you around for the summer, or are you going to go escape?
I don't know. I've got a few kind of applications to residencies out Ooh. In the air now, but I don't know how many are going to come back, and I don't know what months
yeah,
are going to
yeah.
take. Yeah. So okay. that's the kind of thing you end up finding out, like, but a month before.
Right.
And you make some very sudden plans. No, I'm kind of hoping to stay close to home and keep working, but there are some residencies out there that I really want to go to.
They just sound like a dream. Have you done one before?
Yeah, I did one with the University of Windsor.
Okay.
I think it was 2 years ago. It was in 2015. And that was a lot of fun. Because it was University of Windsor had like a separated arts building. They recently moved out of it. It's called the LaBelle Building. I think it was an old fire extinguisher factory or something. Nobody told me that. But it was quite a ways away from the main campus. So it was kind of like the Wild West of art school. You could just get away with anything.
Oh.
And I did. I went with one idea. I'd written a proposal for an idea. Got there, ran some tests, and was like, this isn't going to work. And so I spoke to Lucy Howe, who was in charge of the residency. And I said, I think I want to change this up. And she said, sure, what do you want to do? And I said, axe throwing.
What?
And she said, inside or outside? She didn't even question it. And I wrote a proposal a few times. I wrote the axe throwing proposal. And you get the response you get when you say, I'd like to throw axes in a residency, is no. It's a flat no every time. They're always like, no, these are new floors. Like, we just had these floors redone. And at the University of Windsor, they were like, inside or outside, where do you want to do it? You want to practice inside and then move outside? I was like, this is a dream school.
But so that's what you did.
Yeah, that's what I did. I made a self-portrait that was about, it was 36 by 30 on pine. And then we mounted it to a tree outside at the end of the residency. And we threw hatchets at it.
Oh, my God. Do you have photos of that?
Yeah.
It's not on your site, is it?
There's some on my Instagram. It's from 2 years ago, so it's a little ways back. The finished piece is on my site. It's called a hail. It's the finished piece.
But does it have, like, it all has all hatchet chunks out of it?
Yep. It's because I was trying to get it to splinter. Yeah, I think it's the 13th painting.
Okay, I'm going to go find it.
So what I was trying to do was kind of get it to turn into a pile of splinters on the floor. So there are some pretty big gouges because we moved up from a hatchet to just a full-size axe at this point. we're throwing a full-size axe across a parking lot. And I did get an opportunity to teach the other people who were doing the residency how to throw an axe, which one of them was very good at it. She just took to it like I've never seen anybody take to anything, really. It was amazing.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Oh, it's an amazing thing. It's slowly becoming like a very popular indoor sport here in Toronto. So people are very into axe throwing right now.
Are you serious?
It's a growing thing. You can look it up. I will send you the link for that as God. Well.
There was Ultimate Frisbee in the 90s and now this.
Ultimate Frisbee has nothing on this. I mean, if Ultimate Frisbee and axe throwing ever team up, I'm out.
Yeah,
I'm not,
yeah. I'm so glad you have. I'm so glad you have limits.
I mean, I think as you age, you have to.
Yeah, that's right. No more sour cream.
Yeah, and you switch to green yogurt.
Yeah, that's right. You got to set these limits. Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Okay, Brian, are you ready for my not so speedy speed round?
I guess so.
Okay, you've got no choice. Well, I wrote this before I knew about the chips. Donuts or Doritos?
Oh, Doritos.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Okay, I have two. This is a two-parter. A, did you go to your high school prom? And B, do you wish that you went with somebody from Degrassi Junior High?
Oh, that's a sly question, isn't it?
Yes. That's me doing a little bit of research.
I did go to my prom. I went with Amy Prue.
How did that go?
It was good. It was an interesting evening. We're going to leave it right there.
Okay, that's probably safe. But she did not star in Degrassi Junior High.
She didn't.
Do you wish that, was there anybody, were you secretly in love with? What was her name, Spike?
I always had a little bit of a thing for Melanie.
Yeah, well, didn't everybody?
Unfortunately, Melanie in real life had like a legit stalker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently, like, after the show ended, some guy flew from Australia to here and just wouldn't leave her alone. I think she changed her name.
Oh, my gosh.
She has no social media presence because it scared the life out of her.
Well, I guess.
So, I mean, obviously, that makes perfect sense to me. I can't blame anyone for being scared.
No kidding. Well, I'm going to take a moment and actually explain Degrassi Junior High because the majority of my audience will not know what we were talking about. So this is a Canadian thing, everybody. It was a show. When was that show? In the 80s?
That show ran from 1987 to 1990, I think. Might be 80 to 91. I can't remember.
Okay. And so it was like, you know, a good old Canadian show about these kids in this high school. And if you're Canadian, you knew all about it. You kind of secretly hoped you'd be on it one day. And so are you still doing your little project?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, so tell everybody about that because it is hilarious and awesome. And I went and looked through all the photos and I was just like, this dude is dedicated.
I'm out of it. It's like that project was designed for me to just prove that I'm right all the time. so the project is I was given all three seasons of Degrassi Junior High on DVD as a gift, and I watched all three seasons in one weekend.
Oh god.
When I was like single as all get out, like I was just bored and I didn't feel like leaving the house and I was a little bit depressed. Don't watch that whole series if you're a little bit depressed, because those kids go through everything. Like, every time they try something, it is the worst case scenario. You had sex for the first time, you're pregnant. Like, what? Every time it's like, you tried drugs, you jumped off a bridge.
Right.
So every time it turned out bad. So it's hard to watch kids go through that when you're depressed already.
Oh,
a little bit. I was like going through a breakup and decided this was a good answer.
Sure.
Watch it slowly over time. So while watching it, I've lived in Toronto long enough to kind of, and for a while I was a courier. So I started to recognize a few locations that haven't changed much. There's a few things in the background of the show where I thought, I know where that is. And it was filmed at a time in Toronto where you could just walk out onto any street and just start filming and nobody would mess with you.
Yeah.
Because once upon a time, Toronto was a lot sleepier a town. It wasn't the bustling metropolis that it is today. Everything was kind of filmed just kind of on the street. Let's go. Let's do this. So I spotted a few things while I was watching it, and I thought, that's interesting. I know where that is. And so through the magic of Google Maps and Google Street View, I just started looking up where they were. And I thought, yeah, there it is. I'm right. It's right there. And so I started a map, and I started dropping pins, like, that's where that is. And I would just write it down. And it was just a hobby. I was just kind of like, ah, that's funny, I know where that is, and I would mark it on the map. And then there were some that I couldn't find, and I spent months trying to find Joey Jeremiah's house, which it turned out is down the street from a friend of mine.
Oh, you found it.
I did find it. I did find it.
You go and take pictures, right?
I go, I will ride my bike to the location, and I will photograph it. I bring a still from the show on my phone, and I'll try and line it up as best I can to kind of mimic the shot so that it looks, it's a before and after. It's a then and now. As best I can. Sometimes you can't. A lot of things have been demolished, so sometimes you just can't recreate exactly.
Do you have any locations? Like, do you still have a list, or are you done?
There's still a few from season 3 that I haven't done. Things kind of picked up in the studio, and I got so busy.
Oh, my God. I was going to say, I think you need a hobby, but I think you have one.
This is it. This is the hobby. Oh. It's about taking stills from Degrassi Junior High and then hunting down the location. For no reason other than to prove that I am dead right about where everything is.
Wow. That is hilarious. That sounds like something my dad would do. He just likes to be right all the time. And that's so funny. You know,
dad project for sure.
Totally. Well, before I book anybody on the podcast, like, I do a tiny bit of research and, like, you know, you kind of want to know that, like, are they going to be a good interview? Or are they going to be funny, or they, like, what are they going to be like? And I already loved your work, and then so I did a little searching around about you, and I found this, and I was like, oh, hell yes. Would you like to come on the podcast? Because I thought anybody that would do this will be a good guest.
Probably has something weird to talk about.
Yeah, and he's burning stuff, so it's all good.
I feel like that project kind of hit its, like, weirdness meter when the Toronto Star called me and, like, asked if they could write an article and go to some location. I said, sure.
Wow.
So I'm out there doing a tour of nonsense buildings, like buildings that don't really mean anything. Like, I mean, they were on a show for maybe 2 minutes in 1987.
See, and if the painting thing doesn't work out, this is what you do. You just do, like, you know, it's like the map of the stars, and you, like, take people around in a little bus, and you can just take people around Toronto and show them all these spots. Here's Joey Jeremiah's house.
I get asked that through all the time from the site, because the site's DegrassiPanthers.com.
Oh, and my God.
I get, you know, a message every once in a while that says, I'm coming to Toronto, will you do this? And I just say, I can't. Usually it's at a time when I'm out of town, or I'm just too busy to tour someone around town, because my main means of transportation is also a bicycle. And
right.
Most people in from out of town are not riding bicycles. And Toronto's an interesting place to ride a bike if you're from out of town.
You got to look out for tracks.
Yes.
I learned that the hard way. Yeah. Oh, God. I lived in Toronto for 10 years. I never rode a bike there. I was terrified of those tracks. Did you hook one day?
Yep. I hooked one evening, and I went, what's the expression? Ass over tea kettle.
Oh.
Straight into the road. And I wore a bruise that ran from the middle of my ribs to my knee down one side of my body. For 3 months after that, I managed to land on my body and not my face or
my
head.
But you didn't break anything?
No.
Wow.
Which is surprising, because this happened there was one of those concrete dividers that they put up when they're doing construction. I should have hit the end of that with my face, and I somehow avoided it. I somehow did not hit it and just got up, got back on my bike, and started moving. Another guy riding a bike stopped, and he was like, hey, man, are you okay? And I just kind of looked around, and I wiggled all my fingers and wiggled all my toes, and I said, yes, I think I am.
You must have been in shock.
A little bit. I mean, the bruise really set in. Like, the next morning, I knew that there was going to be a pretty sweet bruise.
Oh. And this is why I did not ride a bike for 10 years.
But that's the only significant fall that I've had in Toronto. And that was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
I still wouldn't do it.
It's It's hard. It's not for the faint of heart if you're going to ride on major streets.
No kidding.
The faint of heart. But
okay, and here's my final question for you. Mm-hmm. Although you might not care about this. Would you rather dye your hair like a rainbow or shave it into a mohawk?
Well, I've already had a mohawk a couple
That's,
of times.
I know, when I saw pictures of you, I'm like, he's not going to care about this at all.
Not a stretch for me to do that. My mother's a hairdresser. It might be fun for her to dye my hair into a rainbow.
You can do that for the next opening.
I don't know if I have it in me, though. My hair has been, like, perfectly brown my entire life, I think.
Oh, well, there you go. There, maybe the would you rather will just push you right over the edge and you'll try it.
I've never actually dyed my hair.
Like, oh, my word. Know. Yeah, me either.
And it's slowly turning, like, beautifully gray.
So is mine. So I just keep adding blonde to hide it. Works like a charm.
I'm just letting it go. I'm just going to let her rip and go totally gray.
That's because you're a dude.
Yeah,
I started going gray at 17. I had a big skunk stripe out of a scar that I had on my forehead. And it's people amazing. Were like, it's so cool. Just let it go. And I was just like, no.
Like a stripe of gray. Like yeah. It looked like he got struck by lightning.
Yeah. Like, what's her name in X-Men? Rogue.
Right, Rogue?
Yeah.
Rogue.
But I can touch people, so that's cool. But yeah, it was like that. And I was just like, not really at 17 in like, you know, the early 90s willing to have that. And now my whole head is white.
I mean, I get it.
I'm not ready.
I mean, I definitely understand it because the thing with guys is you worry about going bald, right?
Right. Same. Yeah. See, it would be same.
Guys get really uptight about going bald. And, you know.
Well, if I ever let mine go completely white, then you could do a painting of me because then it would be cool hair.
It's going to be really hard to do it against a white background.
Oh, yeah.
I'm actually trying to figure out a white hair painting right now. I've actually had this kind of on.
Isn't the one with the bangs though on blue?
I started doing like a little bit of a cloudy background to a lot of things, so it's mostly white with like touches of blue, kind of cloudy shape.
Mm.
I was going for that kind of school picture day background.
Yeah,
but a little more subtle, a little less like. Brooding.
Yeah, and no lasers. Do you remember the ones with the crossed over lasers? I have so many pictures of me with that like pink and blue laser cross in the background.
Justin's photography.
Yeah. They still do it. They oh anyway.
Sure they do.
Yeah.
I'm giving that up.
No, why would you?
The thing is now they send you your photos on a DVD, right?
Yeah.
Or the USB key.
Mm-hmm. So and you can pick the backgrounds.
Yeah, you can change all the background.
Yeah.
I get to hear about it from my sister now because her kids are all in school and it's always a new photo day is always exciting
yeah.
Her house.
Oh,
her kids
I know.
Are so
I know Charlie was very upset a couple of years ago because they made him sit with his elbow like with his fist under his chin, you know, like resting his chin.
Oh.
And he was like, and he was probably 7 at the time. He's like, it looked so dumb. And I think everyone in the school got redos that year because the parents were like, what? Like, what is this? My child has never sat like that in their entire life.
Yeah. Well, who does?
No, nobody.
Anyone ever sitting pensively?
No, I know.
Their chin resting on their fist. I don't know if people do that anymore.
So relaxing. While I'm eating dill pickle dips.
I don't think I've ever done it. I usually sit with my head in my hands going, what am I doing? I need a break
from these fumes. that is all my questions. I think, that's it.
It's
That went really fast. That was an hour and a half.
Yeah, that was a good long talk.
It didn't feel like it. It flew by.
Yeah.
That was really fun, Brian. You're so smart and I love all the stuff you're doing and that little notebook, I'm very excited to see what else gets written in there. It's gonna be good stuff.
It's always different. I will I'm gonna send you over some images, and maybe a link to the video.
Yeah.
I'll send you some stills from that.
I'm going to put it all in because, you know, if people aren't already over there looking now, they're going to want to be because it's, you know, you got to see this stuff in action.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see it in motion.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of video on my Instagram from the axe throwing as well. We did a little bit of video, but that's a much slower process. Fire is very rapid.
Yeah.
Axe throwing takes hours.
Well, sure. You got to really commit. I can go all through your Instagram and grab those videos too from Instagram and just throw them in. So
sure.
Anyway, you send me what you want to send me. This is going up this weekend. And I think everybody's going to love this as much as I did.
Thank you. I had a great time. Thank
Good.
You for having me.
Yeah, thank you for saying yes. And I'll give you a shout when I know my Toronto times, and we'll see if we can connect up.
Sure, absolutely. Oh, okay. By the way, I meant to say, the show you curated at Allison Mill.
Oh, yeah?
Was great.
Oh, did you go?
Yeah, I hadn't been to Allison Mill before, and I thought, oh, well, this is a perfect reason to go. So I kind of wandered there.
Oh, good. Yeah, it was fun. It was such weird stuff and all so cool. And
it was a really exciting group of paintings. It was really, like, I was happy to go to see that. It's not far from me anyway.
Oh, good. Well, I've got the show that I'm going there for in July is at Mayberry. They're opening it. They just opened a new location. They're right across the street from the AGO, you know, in those old cool
right
houses.
Over by Boshi.
Yeah, exactly. And so the show is a dedication to Gord Downie and the Tragically Hip.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool. And again, super Canadian. Might as well. We've got axe throwing and all the stuff. So Degrassi Junior High, might as well throw Tragically Hip in there too. So it was an idea that I had that I really wanted Gord to know that, you know, he doesn't just impact music lovers, but
it's across the board.
Yeah. And so I really thought, you know what, I have a big enough platform now that I can do something. And so I called Mayberry out of the blue. I didn't know them at all, but they represent a few people that I know, and said, what do you think of this idea? And they said, love it. July 8th, so it's happening. So it's so exciting.
I will put that in my calendar.
Okay. So it's called, the show is called That Night in Toronto.
from
Bob Cajun.
Bob Cajun.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So put it in your calendar, everybody. I haven't really officially super announced this yet, but why not? July 8th in Toronto at Mayberry, That Night in Toronto. It's going to be awesome. And 20% of all the sales are going to Gord's brain cancer research fund.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, I got to let you go. It's late there. So thank you so, so much. And it'll go up this weekend, and I'll just see you on email.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that was fun. Anybody that's willing to talk to me at length about chips is A-okay in my books. Not only do I love Brian's love for chips, I am so trying the sour cream and onion Greek yogurt combo thing. I also love how willing he is to take risks, both with his work and his well-being. Thank goodness he invested in a gas mask, and I'm going to assume he's well-versed in stop, drop, and roll when it comes to fire. Thanks to Brian for talking to me for so long. That might be a record for longest Art for Your Ear episode, even though it totally flew by for me. Thank you, as always, to Saatchi Art for supporting the episode, and thank you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.